Hello and welcome to the Interfish Podcast, where we bring you the week's most interesting and compelling seafood news. I'm Drew Cherry. I'm an editor with Intrafish Media. It has been a roller coaster ride for the shrimp industry over the past week. The blockbuster investigations from the Associated Press and the Outlaw Ocean Project were carried in headlines around the globe, sent the industry scrambling to inspect its supply chain, answer customer questions, and in some cases, find new suppliers. Then, hard on the heels of those reports, came a preliminary ruling from the United States that shrimp suppliers from India, Ecuador, and Vietnam received subsidies that gave them an unfair edge on the U.S. market. And to counteract that advantage, the U.S. Department of Commerce is recommending countervailing duties on shrimp from those countries and certain companies that were reviewed. Followed by that, we had the tragic collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, and that offered even more bad news. Shipping insurance rates were likely to rise during a time when shrimp really doesn't need any more additional costs. Now, on last week's podcast, we discussed who came out worst of all in the recent investigations into labor violations in shrimp and whitefish processing plants in India and China, and we landed on one group in particular. Certification standards groups. Many of the facilities and farms accused of labor violations in these recent investigations hold Global Seafood Alliance, Aquaculture Stewardship Council, or Marine Stewardship Council certification, either of their farms or facilities. Now that's left a lot of unanswered questions for the industry. But while certification standards have drawn a lot of the fire, the finger-pointing and blame-shifting isn't doing anyone a whole lot of good. Now, what might is for buyers to take a little more ownership of their responsibilities. We are going to dedicate this entire episode to understanding exactly what responsibility we should expect from certification groups and get an understanding of just how complex the entire endeavor is and what the industry should do in the wake of all these investigations, which raise some legitimate questions about just how much we can trust that the eco labels on seafood are actually delivering what they say they are. To help us make sense of it all, joining us now is Andrew Mallison. He's the former CEO of the Global Seafood Alliance, the former Director General of EFO, the Marine Ingredients Organization, and former Director of Standards and Licensing at the Marine Stewardship Council. We really couldn't have a better person to join us to talk about third-party certifications. Andrew, thanks so much for being here.
Hi, Drew. Thanks for the invitation.
All right. Well, Andrew, it's been, I guess you could say, a turbulent time for standards and certification. Some exposés that have come out recently in the New Yorker and in the Associated Press and all kinds of other outlets have really drawn into question how thorough standards, whether it be the Global Seafood Alliance's Best Aquaculture Practices Standard or the Aquaculture Stewardship Council Standard, Marine Stewardship Council Standards, it's really kind of shown a light on what the limitations of those programs are. There seems to be some lack of clarity on who really holds the responsibility for these failures when there are labor violations and they don't get caught in the certification process, because it would seem that holding these eco labels gives a message to consumers that their seafood has been sustainably caught or harvested and it's been done in a way that's fair to the people processing it. So, Andrew, where did things break down here?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to know where to start because there's always been this confusion about certification. It's like a murky world from the outside. And wherever you go in the value chain, from consumer to retailers to suppliers, there's always this sort of slight difference in interpretation of how it works and how much faith to put in it. Let's start by taking a step back and be on our positive note and say that the world is a better place for certification. And by certification, I mean credible, you know, properly organized certification, not just some piece of paper trumped up by somebody. But where certification helps is that you have knowledgeable people, hopefully a broad stakeholder group, have all got together and said, here's what we all collectively believe from our different perspectives, whether you're an NGO, whether you're industry, whether you're a market-facing partner. This is what we believe is a good, acceptable way of catching fish or farming fish. So you start off from that basis, and that is your standard. Then it starts to get complicated because to give, you know, impartiality and credibility, the people who all agree that's what it should look like aren't going to be the ones who test the standard in a certain circumstance to know whether a particular site passes the standard. That gets handed over to a confusingly named conformity assessment body, CAB, or certification body. And already you're into jargon. Already you're losing people who think, okay, auditor. Can we just call them auditors? Yeah, all right, call them auditors. But these auditors go to a place on a day, maybe 2 days. They ask questions. They compare what they're seeing with what's been written down by these knowledgeable people as how it should look. And they probably find discrepancies and non-conformances. So they think, well, if there's a lot of them, then I'm sorry, you're not going to pass. If there's a few, we're going to let you work on them and we'll give you a pass, providing you fix these things within a period of time. And if there are none, great, you pass straight off. You know? So that is how this works. So that audit happens. It's a snapshot. It's one day. And it is maybe two, sorry. And it heavily relies on the auditors getting everything they need, being shown the right stuff, some honesty and transparency by the site that's being audited. So it's not perfect. It's never going to be an X-ray seeing all there is to that particular site. And there's always going to be this chance that something hasn't been seen, either deliberately or by mistake. And it comes out of the woodwork later on, and then an investigation has to happen. So it's not perfect, but just by virtue of going to see the site and having decided in the first place, what should this look like? The world is a better place for certification. So it's a confusing area, but it's worth the effort for people like the ASC, the MSC, who have try to create credible standards with a massive amount of broad stakeholder consultation. And then obviously they've got to defend it. But it's a very confusing area. And so many commentators, observers make the basic mistake that the standard setter is responsible for the decision about whether to certify or not. And they're not. You know, the MSC are held liable for some problematic fishery, but they didn't certify it. A separate audit body certified it. So that's just the beginning of the divergence of reality to expectation. You then have consumers seeing a badge on a pack of seafood thinking, oh great, this means X, Y, and Z, but it probably doesn't. It probably means a specific set of criteria have been met or not met. And very few of the consumers who see the logos ever look at what those criteria are. They just have this expectation in their heads. I struggle sometimes with knowing how to overcome this huge communications challenge about managing expectations with consumers, with retailers, with suppliers. How do you get clarity? Because I don't think we're doing it well enough at the moment. And this is when problems arise. People's expectations are not realistic. They're expecting more than is actually going to happen from an audit that is just a snapshot of a certain farm or a fishery over a few days.
We still have the challenge of auditors operating in be they plants or farms or countries where honesty may be difficult. And there's also the question of who is paying the auditor, which also makes it difficult because you're being hired by somebody, and maybe you don't want to tell them the absolute worst news that you have to deliver. And second to that is a country like China, for example. Imagine what any of us might do as an auditor, if we had to inspect a partially state-owned company and then tell them that their factory is not up to par, or even worse, has forced labor. I don't think any of us would feel very good or even secure in delivering that news. So how can there be any way to feel that you're going to get what you could really consider a third-party honest audit?
Yeah, well, this is where temptation lies. You have an auditor who is in business. You know, they're making money from the audit, and they are face-to-face with somebody who has also a vested interest in passing that audit, so they get market access, they maybe get a premium for their product. So there's a lot of temptation, and it's not possible. If you think there's always going to be a guaranteed accuracy of an audit, I'm afraid you're fooling yourself. So there needs to be a little bit of reality check when you're looking at certain markets, and you could look at the risk factors, you know, the transparency figures that are published internationally about certain markets, how reliable statistics of any sort are coming from that particular government source. So this is a measure of certification is a tool in managing risk, and that risk is to the buyer's reputation, to the buyer's legal conformance. And as a buyer, you need to be thinking the big picture here. You know, what is it I'm looking for? How much of a guarantee do I need? And if you are in a position of huge trust with your consumer and you have a reputation that you want to protect at all costs, then you're going to have to put a lot more effort into, invest a lot more effort into the audit of those supplies. And you may decide to do it yourself. You're not going to trust a third party at all. And you're probably aware, I had many years the privilege of working for Marks & Spencer in sourcing, and that was their policy. They did not want to trust third parties to do certification inspections on their behalf. They wanted to send their own people. And that's what I did for many years. So you have to start from a risk appraisal point of view. If you need product from that source, how are you going to get some assurance about it? What tools do you have available at your disposal to give you that assurance? And how reliable is that assurance? And you may decide, and this is going to be a very subjective decision based on your company, your brand values, your reputation, your position in the marketplace, that you cannot give yourself sufficient assurance of supply from that location. So this is a decision any sourcing company has to take about where they choose to buy from. And that's influenced by the capacity of the source. You know, they may need a lot of product. They may be a massive operation in their marketplace and they need thousands of tons, which means they have to be a little bit more flexible, shall we say, in their sourcing standards. But if you're very bespoke and very targeted and a very high quality and a huge position of trust, then you can be more specific and selective about your sourcing. So there's a lot of conflict to manage. And this is where I think expectations tend to overwhelm reality, because anybody who's buying seafood and expecting it to be just perfect and everything that they're told is going to be working out to be true is not realistic. So you have to have contingency plans. You have to be doing your best to assure yourself. And if something does go wrong, if there is a problem that's found, how are you going to assure the people that you have been promising this is all great? How are you going to deal with it? Because it's not a perfect world. You know, food recalls happen all around the world all the time. And how you deal with problems is very important. You have to be able to show due diligence. You have to have done the right things in selecting, making your choices in the first place. But dealing with the problem is also extremely important. And at the moment, there's a little bit too much finger pointing that people point at the certification scheme. Certification scheme says, well, actually, we didn't make the decision. It's the certifiers, the auditors, so they point the finger at them. And these are, you know, companies that aren't exactly very high profile. And they say, okay, we'll investigate, and they'll maybe point to their local people, and it all tends to get lost in the mix. So it is a decision process where a lot of knowledge is required about a source, about the potential risks, and that has to be set against the expectations of the marketplace and your particular customer.
So to what extent do you feel like the labor standards of the certifications are working in the way that they are supposed to be working? That obviously was at the heart of the investigations that we've seen come out. Are those standards robust enough? Are they audited in the best way they can be?
Labor's probably the hardest of those sensitive areas to audit. You have so many complications of trying to, often interview workers in a little room off the production hall, and these workers, you're asking them about their conditions, and they want to work, they want their job, and they must be thinking, what should I be saying here? I don't want to get my employer into trouble, I don't want to lose my job. And so from the auditor's point of view, it's a very difficult process. So it almost makes you think about the value of labor audits at all. And I know for many years, the Marine Stewardship Council did not want to get involved in social standards. They wanted to stick to their core competence, which was fisheries and the biological sustainability of those. Because it is so problematic. And I have a feeling that if you just rely on auditing, you are only going to crash and burn. It's just a matter of time. There has to be a stronger bond between the buyer and the supplier, because all those days of the year that the auditor is not on the site are opportunity for an unscrupulous supplier to bring in poor labor standards of many sorts, of which, I could talk for ages about the sort of problems that occur. But there's ample opportunity. And what's going to prevent that? Well, what's going to prevent it is a good supplier-buyer bond, an understanding of the importance of maintaining a standard, being self-motivated in maintaining that standard, knowing that if there was a problem and if it was found out, that business relationship would be over. So the greatest incentive for actually delivering the expectations of consumers is not necessarily the audit. It's the business bond between the supplier and the buyer. And when you first get into quality control, you look at Japanese quality circles and you learn all about how quality is managed, and you realize many, many years ago, food manufacturing moved away from trying to inspect in quality to a production line. You can count the number of broken biscuits at the end of the biscuit packing line all day and all night. But the best thing is to not have them broken in the first place. And who's going to do that? Well, it's the people making the biscuits. So you have to realize that certification is like it's an inspection. It is an assurance. It's not a control. The control is having that mutual understanding, the mutual incentive to get it right and be motivated yourself. Because if you want to be poacher and gamekeeper, it's always going to be an adversarial match. And certification is not going to solve that. It will help. It'll help identify problems that need to be fixed. And maybe, yes, there can be some evidence of problems being addressed. But if you really don't want to have problems longer term, a systematic approach, the commercial relationship is more important than the certification in my eyes.
So were you surprised by the revelations in these stories and the fact that these were certified facilities that were being accused of these violations?
A little disappointed, I guess. But, from a realism point of view, then no, not surprised because I've seen it so many times. You know, I, having audited around the world, visited many plants, knowing that you are being put on a bit of a dog and pony show. You're being shown it at its best, and knowing that one of the questions I used to ask, trying to get under the skin of the supplier, was tell me about the management's policy, about the owner's policy. How do they approach business and their ethics standards? And if it was all a little bit unsure and a bit gray, you know, there's no real glue to what you may be seeing on the day. They could have put on a fantastic show for you. You're gone tomorrow and it all changes. The only thing that's going to give you some comfort that what is happening all the rest of the days of the year, you're not there, is that management and owner's attitude. And you, that's something that's a judgment call for you as an experienced, hopefully, in the business sector you're involved in, and being able to read people and how committed they are to what they say and what evidence then you see with your eyes to back up with what you're hearing.
It sounds like boots on the ground may be more important than seafood companies would have once thought in certain countries.
If you can afford it, yes, that is the best. My perspective. However, I accept that from an efficiency point of view, cost effectiveness point of view, having a credible certificate scheme saves a retailer having to send people all around the world checking on all these plants. Okay, if you have an up-to-date certificate, great, you're in, you're approved as a supplier. But if you do that, it does not abdicate your responsibility as a buyer to try and still assure what it is you're getting. If you're making promises to your marketplace about how that product is manufactured, environmental standards, animal welfare standards, whatever it is that you're pitching as part of your sale to your customer, then you'd better be making sure that you're not just relying on an audit. Take the audit for what it truly is. It's a snapshot. And if as a buyer, you're expecting to, you know, run that up a flagpole and say, look, this we have this is our shield, it's pretty flimsy one, because there are too many chances for it not working, particularly if you have sort of a trading relationship with that particular source where it's all about the price, and then you're stressing their goodwill and how they manage their business for the times that you're not there and they have the opportunity to cut corners. So there's a little bit of disingenuity sometimes in buyers. Oh, we had the certificate. Isn't it awful that these standards haven't been maintained? Well, look, if you're buying shrimp from somewhere and you're insisting on the cheapest possible price, and you didn't really look at the standards, exactly what it is that's being audited or how the standard makes sure that the auditors are qualified to do what they're doing, then really you can't be too claiming, oh, poor me, you know, we've been misled. Well, I'm afraid that doesn't hold much water. You should know better than that.
So when these things come up, and particularly, you know, when a single company is kind of named, a lot of times we'll see big food service companies or retailers say, yep, we've dropped that supplier. Okay. So is that the proper response in these cases, be you a seafood processor or importer or retailer? Or is there a case for kind of leaning in here and continuing to work and improve? Otherwise, you're really just staying one step ahead of the next issue and not really solving anything.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it also comes down to the buyer's policy. You basically have two approaches. One, let's call it dynamic, which means you accept that things are going to move, things are going to change, stuff's going to happen. Do you say, all right, we're going to get involved with these people, we have a red line you cannot cross, you know, whether in food safety or welfare or environmental impact, but if you're above that, and this is what I guess the MSC would talk their 60 points to 80 points kind of zone, will allow you a few non-conformances and will give you time to fix it. And I think most people would say that's the best way of driving change in the longer term, to allow people to continue to supply. They get a financial return on getting certified, and they have to reinvest some of that return on improving their operation under whatever heading it is. So you do drive change, which you can measure and then say, great, okay, you've done those things. We'll do another audit in a couple of years' time. There'll be some more things. You've got to then fix those. And you move on. You progress. That's dynamic. There are others who, and some of the NGO community would be more in this area, have, let's call a go or no-go type of approach. It's either good enough or it's not. There's no middle ground of saying, all right, there's a few things to fix, and when you fix them, then you know we'll talk again. That'd be the go, no-go. So we're not happy with how you are today, and we're not going to buy anything from you until you fix those things, no matter how minor they are. So I think a more realistic approach is the dynamic one. You do incentivize progress. If you just walk away from a non-conformance, you're not providing any incentive to that supplier to fix it. He's just going to go and find another customer who asks fewer questions.
And of course, there's a financial element to all this that sometimes gets forgotten. The certification bodies need to have fisheries and farms sign up, and they need to keep that flow of clients coming in. It's quite competitive, is it not, to between some of these certification bodies to go out and sign up companies?
I mean, the way the world works, there's competition for funding. Whether you're an NGO who needs to make some headlines about a cause to attract funding from a philanthropic source who is concerned about this particular issue and wouldn't, you know, had it brought to their attention, or yeah, okay, we'll get our checkbooks out. Or whether you are a certification scheme who needs a certain amount of logoed products to demonstrate to the marketplace, yeah, you back us. You get in with our scheme and you can have consistency of logos across your estate, your range of products. There is definitely competition. How you deal with that in the real world is something that I think the retailers have to decide about. They don't want to have lots of, like, the Cub Scout jersey we often talk about, all of these badges on their packaging. And this is something that's a branding question and really gets into a lot of the weeds of how you present your brand, how you message it to your consumers. Do you need logos at all on your packaging, or should your brand name carry every assurance that's needed to the consumer? And if the consumer wants to know, how are you backing up this assurance you've just given us? Well, that's when maybe a website or through some other materials you can say, well, because we engage with all of these schemes, and if you want to know for which product, it's that scheme. It's kind of a complicated subject. We could probably talk for another hour just about that, frankly.
I won't keep you another hour, but I do want to talk about that topic a little bit more. So the logo licensing fees are very, very important to these certification groups. And yet we're kind of in this place where you just said, where the idea of exporting the responsibility in among major retailers, for example, onto certification groups seems to really be showing its limitations. And I know that a big effort has been made by ASC, GSA, MSC to really convince fisheries and farms that they will help market their product. They can get that additional premium for certified product. But in the process of doing that and kind of convincing producers to carry logos, this sort of loops back around to what we began the conversation on, which is that logo carrying too much weight, as it were, in the mind of a consumer about what it actually means.
Yes. Yeah. I think if that's the tendency, the slippery slope, because if you are saying that this product, by virtue of it carrying a logo, is going to cost you more money, you then have to make all sorts of promises about, well, what does the logo mean? And you rarely, because it's a complex area, standard setting, very rarely can communicate to the consumer in realistic terms what the logo means. And so organic is a classic example. You know, lots of people would say, oh, it's labeled organic, therefore it's going to cost about a third more. That must mean it's free of chemicals or grown in this way. Well, not necessarily. You know, and until you go back to the standard and see, oh, they do allow some chemicals and fertilizers or animal treatments, medicines. So it's a tricky proposition to say we're going to charge more for this product, but be clear about what exactly you get for that extra money. I don't know of a way yet that effectively works with consumers to tell them accurately, unless that consumer has a great amount of time on their hands to do all the research, what they're getting for their money, which is probably why retailers have often found it hard to capture a premium. And in my experience of when I was in retail, when we put a logo on product, we couldn't sell it for any more. And we didn't sell any more volume either in it. And when we took the logo off because of a packaging cleanup sweep that the company decided to do, take all logos off product, we didn't sell any less either. So the consumer sort of sees these little logos on packaging, I think gets a little bit of a warm feeling. And I think this is, I'm generalizing now, obviously, but the majority of customers probably don't even look. There will be a few who look and think, oh, well, that's good. I'm glad it's sustainable, but they're the minority. And even the smaller minority than that will actively understand what that logo means. So we mustn't get carried away with the importance of logos in the consumer's mind. I mean, there will be awareness ratings, which can sound very promising, but what does awareness mean? You know, do they understand what has gone into awarding that logo on that product? Probably not.
So are you saying that the retailers, food service companies, and seafood companies should be shouldering a bit more of the burden than they have been, in the sense that, as you said earlier, there seems to have been this idea that I've got my stamp, I've got my logo on my package, my work is done. Mm-hmm. Are we in a period now where we need to start rethinking that and even demanding that retailers and processors take on a bit more responsibility?
I think so, because if you are a retailer and that's your stance, our work is done, you're just going to set yourself up for the next expose where somebody has found out a problem in your supply chain and it makes the news. So you cannot abdicate this responsibility as a buyer and should not. But you've got to start with the consumer. Understand your particular customer. Obviously, there will be customers who care. There will be markets that care about certain areas and sensitivities that certification addresses. And there will be other markets which don't care and aren't interested, don't ask questions, couldn't be bothered, not really on their radar. They're far more interested in the price per pound or per kilo, whatever it is. So firstly, the retailer has to understand the consumer's expectations. What is the consumer coming to them for? And what's the mix of components in the product value? Obviously, there's a price per kilo. There's a nutritional level. There's this food safety aspect. But there's also a conscientious ethical element, which varies between consumers of particular stores and retailers compared to others. So the starting point is for the retailer to understand the consumer's expectations and what are they trying to deliver. Once they understand that, they can think, how do we deliver that? do we do it ourselves and go and see all these people to make sure they're meeting a standard which we've either generated ourselves internally or we've taken off the shelf by some august body like the Marine Stewardship Council? Choice is yours. You know, what do you do? But if you delegate that responsibility to a third party, know that it is not perfect and you will have to be transparent about, oh, we found a problem. Let's be honest about it. Let's own up. How are we going to deal with it? What was the corrective action? Let's make it known to anybody who's concerned. This is what was done about it. So some transparency about corrective action is required. But it starts with tailoring your stance from your consumer back up through the value chain and having a good dose of reality, knowing that if you are in a trading relationship with a particular supplier, and I'm going to say shrimp because it's such a huge commodity around the world, if you have a price-based trading relationship with a shrimp commodity supplier, you cannot be 100% sure that your certification is going to be representative of every day's, you know, of the year's production, because there are, the audit and the certification is a snapshot. It's a educated snapshot. It looks at systems, it looks at management and so on, but it's a snapshot nevertheless. So you have to understand the incentives for, you know, it's like if you're, are you choosing to go down a nice smooth motorway, or are you choosing the bumpy road, in which case your suspension is going to take a hammering, and don't be surprised if a wheel falls off.
Andrew, thanks so much. I always appreciate you coming on and helping illuminate some of these really complex ideas around certification.
Oh, you're welcome. It's not an easy area to get your head around, and I'm still learning. I still think, as I said right at the opening, that the world is a better place for certification, faults and all. You know, it has moved the needle. Fisheries are more sustainable. People who are trying to do the right way, farming or fishing, are getting the recognition that they deserve. And long may that continue.
Well, Andrew, you technically are in semi-retirement, but what else are you doing now with yourself? You've got 40 years of experience and knowledge in the seafood industry, and I know very few people that have been in the industry that long that completely step away.
I thought the river of life as such had carried me away from seafood land, but it's still, I think it's in the blood. And there are things like mentoring. Things I've enjoyed the most have been those people areas where I'd help younger people coming into the industry in some small way, and they remembered that. And I find that hugely rewarding, that if you can pass on, you know, I'm sure you feel the same. You've had all of these times when knowledgeable people have shared their time with you, told you how they do things, and it's been very generous with their time. And it's a way of passing that on, I think, to other people, helping them with problems they may have in their workplace, because the seafood industry is a peculiar place. Not being a therapist, not being a counselor, but just being a good listener and using what little experience I've gained over the years to maybe shed some light and give them a perspective on how they might face challenges in their workplace, whether they're personal or professional.
Well, I remember a certain 25-year-old reporter that showed up at the offices of Marks & Spencer asking for the seafood buyer. And remarkably, you sat down with me and explained some of the very basics of how seafood retailing worked and supply chains, and indulged a lot of impertinent and foolish questions. And here we are 20 years later, and I'm still asking you foolish and impertinent questions.
If that's the sort of thing I've managed to help somebody in some small way, then I feel is the way it's paid back those who invested their time in me.
Well, thanks again, Andrew. Always a pleasure. Well, that's going to wrap up this edition of the IntraFish podcast. Remember that you can find us on intrafish.com 24/7. And do not forget, you can go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe to the IntraFish podcast so that it comes right to your phone as soon as it's released. All right, folks, we'll be back next week. Thanks again for joining us.